City of New York would see it. Miss Shelley Thomas would see it. Chapter 19. Donkey Loyalty. First thing Monday morning, Kramer and Bernie Fitzgibbon were summoned into Abe Weiss's office. Milt Lovell was there, too. Kramer could tell that his status had improved over the weekend. Weiss now called him Larry instead of Kramer, and didn't direct every comment about the Lamb case to Bernie as if he, Kramer, were nothing but Bernie's foot soldier. But Weiss was looking at Bernie when he said,
"I don't want to have to futz around with this thing if I don't have to. Have we got enough to bring in this guy McCoy or not?"
"We got enough, Abe," said Fitzgibbon. "But I'm not completely happy with it. We got this character, Auburn, who identifies McCoy as the guy who was driving the car that hit Lamb, and we got the garage attendant who says McCoy had his car out at the time the thing happened, and Martin and Goldberg found the gypsy cab operator, Brill, who verifies that Auburn used one of his cabs that evening. But they haven't found the driver, this Curly Kale." He rolled his eyes and sucked in his breath as if to say, "These people and their names." "And I think we ought to talk to him first."
"Why?"
asked Weiss.
"Because there's certain things that don't make sense, and Auburn's a fucking low-life drug dealer who's out from under his rock. I'd still like to know why Lamb didn't say anything about being hit by a car when he first went to the hospital. I'd like to know what went on in that cab, and I'd like to know if Auburn actually took the kid to the hospital. I'd like to know a little more about Auburn, too. You know, him and Lamb ain't the types who go walking over to the Texas Fried Chicken together. I gather Lamb is a kind of good-doing boy, and Auburn's a player."
Kramer felt an odd passion rising in his breast. He wanted to defend the honor of Roland Auburn. Yes, defend him. Weiss waved his hand in a gesture of dismissal.
"Loose ends is what that sounds like to me, Bernie. I don't know why we can't bring McCoy in and book him and then tie up the loose ends. Everybody takes this we're investigating business to be a stalling tactic."
"A couple more days ain't gonna matter, Abe. McCoy's not going anywhere, and Auburn certainly ain't going anywhere." Kramer saw an opening, and, buoyed by his new status, plunged in.
"We could have a problem there, Bernie."
"It's true, Auburn..." He started to say isn't, but switched to ain't.
"Ain't going anywhere, but I think we ought to use him quickly. He probably thinks he's getting out on bail any minute. We ought to get the guy in front of a grand jury as soon as we can, if we're going to use him."
"Don't worry about that," said Fitzgibbon. "He ain't brilliant, but he knows he's got a choice between 3 years in jail and no years in jail. He's not going to shut up on us."
"That's the deal we made?" asked Weiss. "Auburn gets nothing?"
"That's the way it'll wind up. We gotta dismiss the indictment and knock the charge down to misdemeanor possession, misdemeanor sale."
"Shit," said Weiss. "I wish we hadn't moved so fast with the son of a bitch. I don't like to dismiss grand jury indictments."
"Abe," said Fitzgibbon, smiling, "you said it, I didn't. All I'm telling you is take it a little slower."
"I'd feel a lot better if we had something else to nail down what he says."
Kramer couldn't hold back.
"I don't know. What he says stands up pretty well. He was telling me things he had to be there to know about. He knew the color of the car, the number of doors. He knew it was a sports model. He knew McCoy's first name. He heard it as Shaman, but I mean, that's pretty close. There's no way he could have dreamed up all that."
"I'm not saying he wasn't there, Larry.
And I'm not saying we don't use him. We use him. I'm just saying he's a slime ball and we ought to be careful."
"Slime ball? This is my witness you're talking about."
"I don't know, Bernie," he said. "From what I've been able to find out so far, he's not all that bad a kid. I got hold of a probation report. He's not a genius, but he's never been around anybody who's ever made him use his head. He's third-generation welfare. His mother was 15 when he was born, and she's had two other kids by different fathers. And now she's living with one of Roland's buddies, a 21-year-old kid, just a year older than Roland. He's moved right in there to the apartment, along with Roland and one of the other two kids. I mean, Jesus Christ, can you imagine? I think I'd have a worse record than him. I doubt that he's ever known a relative that lived outside the projects."
Bernie Fitzgibbons was now smiling at him. Kramer was startled, but plowed on.
Another thing I found out about him, he has some talent. His probation officer showed me some pictures he's done. They're really interesting. They're these, what do you call them, collages? Said Fitzgibbon. Yeah, said Kramer. Collages, with these sort of silver-crushed aluminum foil for the skies. Yeah, you've seen them? Where'd you see them? I haven't seen Auburn's, but I've seen a lot like it. It's jailhouse art. What do you mean? You see it all the time. They do these pictures in jail, these figures, kind of like cartoon figures, right? And then they fill in the background with Crush Reynolds rap. Yeah, I see that crap all the time. Must be two or three lawyers come in here every year with these tinfoil pictures telling me I'm keeping Michelangelo behind bars. Well, that may be, said Kramer, but I'd say this kid has some real talent. Fitzgibbon said nothing. He just smiled. And now Kramer knew what the smile was all about. Bernie thought he was trying to light up his witness. Kramer knew all about that, but this was different. Lighting up the witness was a common psychological phenomenon among prosecutors. In a criminal case, your star witness was likely to be from the same milieu as the defendant and might very well have a record himself. He was not likely to be known as a pillar of probity, and yet he was the only star witness you had. At this point, you were likely to feel the urge to light him up with the lamp of truth and credibility. But this was not merely a matter of improving his reputation in the eyes of a judge and jury. You felt the urge to sanitize him for yourself. You needed to believe that what you were doing with this person, namely using him to pack another person off to jail, was not only effective, but right. This worm, this germ, this punk, this erstwhile asshole was now your comrade, your point man in the battle of good against evil, and you yourself wanted to believe that a light shone round about this organism, this former vermin from under the rock, now a put-upon and misunderstood youth. He knew all about that, but Roland Auburn was different. All right, said Abe Wise, putting an end to the aesthetic debate with another wave of his hand. It don't matter. I gotta make a decision, and I've made a decision. We got enough. We're bringing McCoy in. We bring him in tomorrow morning, and we make the announcement. Tuesday's a good day. He looked at Milt Lovell when he said that. Lovell nodded sagely. Tuesday and Wednesday are the best. Tuesday and Wednesday. He turned to Bernie Fitzgibbon. Mondays are lousy. All people do on Mondays is read about sports all day and watch ball games at night. But Fitzgibbon was looking at Weiss. Finally, he shrugged and said, Okay, Abe. I can live with that. But if we're gonna do it tomorrow, I better call Tommy Killian right now before he goes into court to make sure he can produce his man. Weiss motioned toward the small table and the telephone at the end of the room beyond the conference table, and Fitzgibbon headed down there. While Fitzgibbon was on the telephone, Weiss said, Where are those pictures, Milt? Milt Lovell dug through a pile of papers in his lap and came up with several pages from a magazine and handed them to Weiss.
What's the name of this magazine, Milt? Architectural Digest. Look at this.
The next thing Kramer knew, Weiss was leaning across the desk and handing them to him. He felt tremendously flattered. He studied the pages. The creamiest paper imaginable. Lush photographs in color with details so sharp it made you blink. McCoy's apartment. A sea of marble led up to a great curved staircase with a dark wood balustrade. Dark wood everywhere, and an ornate table with about a truckload of flowers rising up from out of a big vase. It was the hall Martin had been talking about. It looked big enough to put three of Kramer's $888-a-month ant colony in, and it was only a hall. He had heard that there were people who lived like this in New York. Another room, more dark wood. Must be the living room. So big. There were three or four clumps of heavy furniture in it, the kind of room you walk into when you turn your voice down to a whisper. Another picture. A close-up of some carved wood, a lustrous reddish-tan wood. All these figures in suits and hats walking this way and that at odd angles in front of buildings. And now Weiss was leaning across his desk and pointing at the picture.
Get a load of that, he said. Wall Street, it's called, by Wing Wong or some goddamn person. Hong Kong's master woodcarver. Isn't that what it says there? It's on the wall of the library. I like that.
Now Kramer could see what Martin had been talking about. The library. The wasps. 38, only 6 years older than he was. They were left all this money by their parents, and they lived in fairyland. Well, this one was heading for a collision with the real world. Fitzgibbon returned from the other end of the room.
"You talk to Tommy?" asked Weiss.
"Yeah, he'll have his man ready."
"Take a look at this," said Weiss,
motioning toward the magazine pages. Kramer handed them to Fitzgibbon.
"McCoy's apartment," said Weiss.
Fitzgibbon took a quick look at the pictures and handed them back to Kramer.
"You ever seen anything like it?" asked Weiss. "His wife was the decorator. Am I right, Milt?"
"Yeah, she's one of these social decorators," said Lovell. "One of these rich women who decorate places for other rich women. They run articles about them in New York Magazine."
Weiss kept looking at Fitzgibbon, but Fitzgibbon said nothing. Then Weiss opened his eyes wide in a look of revelation.
"Can you picture it, Bernie?"
"Picture what?"
"Well, here's the way I see it," said Weiss. "What I think would be a good idea, to stop all this bullshit about white justice and Johannes Bronx and all that crap, is we arrest him in his apartment. I think that would be a hell of a thing. You want to tell the people of this borough that the law is no respecter of persons, you arrest the guy from Park Avenue the same way you arrest Jose Garcia or Tyrone Smith. You go into their fucking apartment, am I right?"
"Yeah," said Fitzgibbon. "Because they ain't coming in any other way."
"That's not the point. We have an obligation to the people of this borough. This office is being held up to them in a very bad light, and this'll put an end to that."
"Isn't that kind of rough, taking a guy in his home to make a point?"
"There's no wonderful way to get arrested, Bernie."
"Well, we can't do that," said Fitzgibbon.
"Why not?"
"Because I just told Tommy we wouldn't do it that way. I told him he could surrender McCoy himself."
"Well, I'm sorry, but you shouldn't have done that, Bernie. We can't guarantee anybody will give his client special treatment, you know that."
"I don't know that, Abe. I gave him my word." Kramer looked at Weiss. Kramer knew the donkey had now dug in, but did Weiss? Apparently not.
"Look, Bernie, you just tell Tommy I overruled you, okay? You can blame it on me. I'll take the heat for it. We'll make it up to Tommy."
"Negative," said Fitzgibbon. "You're not gonna have to take the heat, Abe, because it's not gonna happen. I gave Tommy my word. It's a contract."
"Yeah, well, sometimes you just gotta..."
"Ungots, Abe. It's a contract." Kramer kept his eyes on Weiss. Bernie's repetition of the word contract had gotten to him. Kramer could see it. Weiss had come to a dead stop. Now he knew he was up against that obstinate Irish code of loyalty. Silently, Kramer begged Weiss to throw his subordinate aside. Donkey loyalty? It was obscene. Why should he, Kramer, have to suffer for the sake of the fraternal solidarity of the Irish? A highly publicized arrest of this Wall Street investment banker in his apartment had happened to be a brilliant idea. Demonstrate the even-handedness of justice in the Bronx. Absolutely. Assistant District Attorney Lawrence Kramer. The Times, the News, the Post, the City Light, Channel One, and the rest of them would know his name by heart soon enough. Why should Abe Weiss cave in to the code of these harps? And yet he knew he would. He could see it in his face. It wasn't just Bernie Fitzgibbon's black Irish toughness, either. It was also that word, contract. That cut straight to the soul of every lifer in this business. At the Favor Bank, all due bills had to be redeemed. That was the law of the criminal justice system, and Abe Weiss was nothing if not a creature of the system.
"Well, shit, Bernie," said Weiss. "What'd you do that for? For Christ's sake!"
The standoff was over. "Believe me, Abe, you're gonna look better this way. They can't say you gave in to the passions of the crowd."
"Well, next time don't make these commitments without running them by me."
Bernie just looked at him and gave him a tiny smile that as much as said once more, "Ungots." Chapter 20. Calls from Above. Gene Lopwitz didn't receive visitors at his desk.
He sat them down in a cluster of huge English Chippendale wing chairs and Irish Chippendale side tables in front of the fireplace. The Chippendale cluster, like the other clusters of furniture in the vast space, was the brainchild of Ronald Vine, the decorator. But the fireplace was Lopwitz's. The fireplace worked. The bond trading room stewards, who were like aged bank guards, could actually build a log fire in it, a fact that had provided several weeks of sniggers for in-house cynics such as Raleigh Thorpe. Being a modern office tower, the building had no chimney flues, but Lopwitz, after a year of stupendous success, was determined to have a working fireplace with a carved wood mantelpiece in his office. And why? Because Lord Upland, owner of the London Daily Courier, had one. The austere peer had given a lunch for Lopwitz in his suite of offices in a grand old brick building on Fleet Street in hopes of having him flog a lot of creatively structured Daily Courier stock to the Yanks. Lopwitz had never forgotten how a butler had come in from time to time to put a log on the warm and toasty, pungent fire in the fireplace. It was so, how should one say it, so baronial it was. Lopwitz had felt like a fortunate little boy who had been invited to the home of a great man. Home. That was the ticket. The British, with that ever-sure class instinct of theirs, realized that if a man was at the top in business, he should not have the standard business office which made one look like an interchangeable part in a large mechanism. No. One should have an office that looked like the home of a nobleman, as much as to declare, I, personally, am the Lord Creator and Master of this great organization. Lopwitz had ended up in a terrific fight with the tower's owners and the management company that ran it for them, and the city's building department and fire department, and the construction of the flues and vents had cost $350,000, but he had finally had his way. And Sherman McCoy now stared reflectively into the mouth of that baronial hearth, 50 floors above Wall Street, off the bond trading floor of Pearson Pierce. There was no fire in the fireplace, however. There had been none for a long time. Sherman could feel an electrical thrill of tachycardia in his chest. Both of them, Lopwitz and himself, were sitting in the wingback Chippendale monsters. Lopwitz wasn't very good at small talk on even the happiest occasions, and this little meeting was going to be grim. The fireplace. The chiggers. Christ. Well, anything was better than looking like a beaten dog. So Sherman straightened himself up in the chair, lifted his great chin, and even managed to look slightly down his nose at the lord and master of this mighty organization.
"Sherman," said Gene Lopwitz. "I'm not going to beat around the bush with you. I got too much respect for you to do that."
The electrical trill in his chest. Sherman's mind raced along with his heart, and he found himself wondering quite idly whether or not Lopwitz knew where the phrase "beat around the bush" came from. Probably not.
"I had a long talk with Arnold on Friday," Lopwitz was saying. "Now, what I'm going to say to you, I want to make one thing clear. It's not the money, or it's not any money that was lost. That's not the issue here."
This expedition out onto the psychological terrain threw Lopwitz's already sunken cheeks into perplexed creases. He was a jogging zealot, 5 a.m. breed. He had the gaunt and haunted athletic look of those who stare daily down the bony gullet of the great god aerobics. Now he was into the business of Oscar Suter and the United Fragrance Bonds, and Sherman knew he should pay close attention. United Fragrance Bonds, Oscar Suter. And he thought of the city light. What did it mean, close to a major break in the Henry Lamb case? The story, by this same Fallow, was bafflingly vague, except to say that the break had been triggered by the city light story about the possible license plate numbers. Triggered. That was the word they used. Somehow that word had set off the tachycardia as he sat hidden in the toilet booth. None of the other newspapers carried any such story. Now Lopwitz was going on about the business of his being AWOL the day the big bond issue came in. Sherman could see Freddie Button's foppish hands fluttering about the cigarette case. Gene Lopwitz's lips were moving. The telephone on the Irish Chippendale table beside Lopwitz's wing chair rang with a discreet murmuring burble. Lopwitz picked it up and said, "Yeah? Okay, good. Is he on the line yet?" Unaccountably, Lopwitz now beamed at Sherman and said, "Only take a second. I gave Bobby Shafflett a lift on the plane so he could keep a date in Vancouver. They're up over Wisconsin or South Dakota or some goddamn place." Lopwitz now lowered his eyes and sank back in the wing chair and beamed in anticipation of talking to the famous Golden Hillbilly, whose famous buttery bulk and tenor voice were now encased in Lopwitz's own 8-seat jet aircraft with Rolls-Royce engines. Strictly speaking, it was Pearson Pierce's, but to all practical purposes, it was his, personally, baronially. Lopwitz lowered his head, and great animation came over his face, and he said, "Bobby? Bobby? Can you hear me? What's that? How's it going? They treating you all right up there? What? Hello? Hello? Bobby? You still there? Hello? Can you hear me? Bobby?" Still holding the telephone, Lopwitz looked at Sherman with a scowl, as if he had just done something far worse than get suckered on the United Fragrance deal or go absent without leave. "Shit," he said. "Lost the connection." He clicked the receiver. "Miss Bales, lost the connection. See if you can get the plane again." He hung up and looked miserable. He had lost the opportunity to have the great artist, the great ball of fat and fame, pay him his thanks and thereby homage to the Lopwitz eminence from the skies 40,000 feet over the American heartland. "Okay, where were we?" asked Lopwitz, looking as angry as Sherman had ever seen him. "Oh yeah, the Giscar." Lopwitz began shaking his head as if something truly dreadful had happened, and Sherman braced, because the debacle of the gold-backed bonds was the worst of it. In the next instant, however, Sherman had the eerie feeling that Lopwitz was really shaking his head over the broken telephone connection. The telephone rang again. Lopwitz pounced on it. "Yeah? You got the plane? What? Well, all right, put him through." This time, Lopwitz looked at Sherman and shook his head with frustration and bewilderment, as if Sherman was his understanding friend. "It's Ronald Vine. He's calling from England. He's out in Wiltshire. He's found some linen-fold paneling for me. They're 6 hours ahead of us there, so I gotta take it." His voice asked for understanding and forgiveness. Linen-fold paneling? Sherman could only stare. But apparently fearful that he might say something at such a critical juncture, Lopwitz held up one finger and closed his eyes for a moment. "Ronald? Where are you calling from?" "That's what I thought. No, I know it very well. What do you mean they won't sell it to you?" Lopwitz fell into a deep discussion with the decorator, Ronald Vine, about some impediment to the purchase of the linen-fold paneling in Wiltshire. Sherman looked at the fireplace again. The chiggers. Lopwitz had used the fireplace for just about 2 months, and then never again. One day, while sitting at his desk, he had suffered an intense itching and burning sensation on the underside of his left buttock. Fiery red blisters he had. Chigger bites. The only plausible deduction was that somehow chiggers had found their way to the 50th floor, to the mighty bond-trading floor of Pearson Pierce in a load of firewood for the hearth, and had bitten the Baron on the bottom. On the brass andirons at this moment was a stack of carefully chosen New Hampshire hardwood logs, sculpturally perfect, perfectly clean, utterly antiseptic, buggered with enough insecticide to empty a banana grove of everything that moves, permanently installed, never to be lit. Lopwitz's voice rose. "What do you mean they won't sell it to trade?" "Yeah, I know they said it to you, but they know you're getting it from me. What are they talking about, trade?"
"Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you tell them I got a word for them. Trafe. Let them figure it out for themselves. If I'm trade, they're trafe. What's it mean? It means, like, not kosher, only it's worse than that. In plain English, I guess the word is shit. There's an old saying, if you look close enough, everything is trafe, and that goes for these moth-eaten aristocrats, too, Ronald. Tell them to take their linen-fold panels and shove them."
Lopwitz hung up and looked at Sherman with great irritation.
"All right, Sherman, let's get down to cases."
He sounded as if Sherman had been stalling, arguing, evading, double-talking him, and otherwise trying to drive him crazy.
I can't figure out what happened with the Giscard. Let me ask you something.
He cocked his head and put on the look that says, I'm a shrewd observer of human nature. I'm not prying, he said, but I want you to tell me anyway. You having trouble at home or something? For a moment, Sherman entertained the notion of appealing, man to man, for pity, and revealing just an inch or two of his infidelity. But a sixth sense told him that problems at home would only arouse Lopwitz's contempt and his appetite for gossip, which seemed to be considerable, so he shook his head and smiled slightly to indicate that the question didn't even trouble him, and said, "No, not at all."
"Well, do you need a vacation or something?"
Sherman didn't know what to say to that, but his spirits rose. At least it didn't sound as if Lopwitz was about to fire him. In fact, he didn't have to say anything because the telephone rang again. Lopwitz picked up the receiver, although not so rapidly this time.
"Yeah? What's that, Miss Bales?"
"Sherman?"
A big sigh. "Well, he's right here."
Lopwitz looked at Sherman quizzically.
"Seems to be for you."
He held out the receiver. Very odd. Sherman got up, took the receiver, and stood beside Lopwitz's chair.
"Hello?"
"Mr. McCoy?"
It was Miss Bales, Lopwitz's secretary.
"There's a Mr. Killian on the line. He says it's imperative that he speak to you. Do you want to speak to him?"
Sherman felt a thud of palpitation in his chest. Then his heart kicked off into a steady, galloping tachycardia.
"Yes, thank you."
A voice said,
"Sherman."
It was Killian. He had never called him by his first name before.
"I had to get hold of you."
"I'm in Mr. Lopwitz's office," said Sherman in a formal voice.
"I know that," said Killian, "but I had to make sure you didn't leave the building or something before I got hold of you. I just got a call from Bernie Fitzgibbon. They claim they got a witness who can make the people who were at the scene. You follow me?"
"Make?"
"Identify him."
"I see. Let me call you when I get back to my desk." Composed.
"Okay, I'm in my office, but I gotta head to court, so make it quick. There's one very important thing you gotta know. They're gonna want to see you officially tomorrow. Officially, okay? So you call me back immediately."
The way Killian said officially, Sherman could tell it was a code expression, in case someone in Lopwitz's office had access to the conversation.
"All right," he said, composed. "Thank you."
He put the receiver back on the cradle on the Irish Chippendale table and sat back down in the wing chair, in a daze. Lopwitz continued as if the call had never taken place.
"As I told you, Sherman, the question is not that you lost money for Pearson Pierce. That's not what I'm saying. The Giscard was your idea. It was a great strategy, and you thought of it. But I mean, for Christ's sake, you worked on it for 4 months, and you're our number one bond salesman out there. So it isn't the money you lost for us. It's that here you are. You're a guy who's supposed to function the best out there. And now we got a situation where we got a whole string of these things that I've been talking to you about."
Lopwitz stopped talking and stared with astonishment as Sherman, without a word, stood up in front of him. Sherman knew what he was doing, but at the same time he seemed to have no control over it. He couldn't just stand up and walk out on Gene Lopwitz in the middle of a crucial talk about his performance at Pearson Pierce, and yet he couldn't sit there another second.
"Gene," he said, "you'll have to excuse me. I have to leave."
He could hear his own voice as if he were hearing it from outside.
"I'm really sorry, but I have to."
Lopwitz remained seated and looked at him as if he'd gone crazy.
"That call," said Sherman. "I'm sorry."
He started walking out of the office. In his peripheral vision, he was aware of Lopwitz following him with his eyes. Out on the floor of the bond trading room, the morning madness had reached its peak. As he headed toward his desk, Sherman felt as if he were swimming through a delirium.
"October 92 is at the book.
I said we stripped the fuckers."
Ah, the golden crumbs. How pointless it seemed. As he sat down at his desk, Arguello approached and said,
"Sherman, do you know anything about 10 million Joshua III SNLs?"
Sherman waved him back, the way you would warn someone away from a fire or the edge of a cliff. He noticed his forefinger shaking as he pressed out Killian's number on the telephone. the receptionist answered, and in his mind, Sherman could see the scalding brightness of the reception area in the old building on Reed Street. In a moment, Killian was on the line.
"You someplace you can talk?" he asked.
"Yes. What did you mean they want to see me officially?"
"They want to bring you in. It's unethical, it's unnecessary, it's bullshit, but that's what they're gonna do."
"Bring me in?" Even as he said it, he had the dreadful feeling he knew what Killian meant. The question was an involuntary prayer from his very central nervous system that he be wrong.
"They're gonna place you under arrest. It's outrageous. They should take whatever they got before a grand jury and get an indictment and then see about an arraignment. Bernie knows that, but Weiss has gotta have a quick arrest to get the press off his back."
Sherman's throat went dry with "place you under arrest." The rest was just words.
"Under arrest?"
A croak.
"Weiss is an animal," said Killian, "and he's a whore for the press."
"Under arrest? You can't be serious. Please don't let it be true. What are they charging me with?"
"Reckless endangerment, leaving the scene of an accident, and failure to report."
"I can't believe it. Please make this unreal."
"Reckless endangerment? But from what you said, I mean, how can they? I wasn't even driving."
"Not according to their witness. Bernie said the witness picked your picture out from a set of photographs."
"But I wasn't driving. I'm only telling you what Bernie told me. He says the witness also knew the color of your car and the model."
Sherman was aware of his own rapid breathing and the roar of the bond trading room. Killian said,
"You there?"
Sherman, hoarsely,
"Yes. Who is this witness?"
"That he wouldn't tell me."
"Is it the other boy?"
"He wouldn't say.
Or, Christ, Maria?"
"He's not gonna tell me that."
"Did he say anything about the woman in the car?"
"No. They're gonna keep the details to themselves at this point, but look, let me tell you something. This is not gonna be as bad as you think. I got a commitment from Bernie. I can bring you up there and surrender you myself. You'll be in there and out of there, ba-bing."
In and out of what? But what he said was, "Surrender me?"
"Yeah. If they wanted, they could come downtown and arrest you and take you up there in handcuffs."
"Up where?"
"The Bronx. But that's not gonna happen. I got a commitment from Bernie, and by the time they release it to the press, you'll be out of there. You can be thankful for that."
The press, the Bronx, surrender, reckless endangerment, one grotesque abstraction after another. All at once he was desperate to visualize what was about to happen, to picture it, no matter what it was, rather than simply feel the horrible force closing in about him. Killian said,
"You there?"
"Yes."
"You can thank Bernie Fitzgibbon. You remember what I was telling you about contracts? This is a contract between me and Bernie."
"Look," said Sherman, "I've got to come by and talk to you. Right now I got to go over to court. I'm already late. But I should be through by 1. Come on over around 1. You're probably going to need a couple of hours anyway." This time Sherman knew exactly what Killian was talking about.
"Oh, God," he said in his now husky voice. "I've got to talk to my wife. She doesn't know the first thing about any of this."
He was talking as much to himself as to Killian. "And my daughter, and my parents, and Lopwitz. I don't know. I can't tell you. This is absolutely incredible."
"It's like the ground's been cut out from under you, right? That's the most natural thing in the world. You're not a criminal, but it's not going to be as bad as you think. This don't mean they got a case. It just means they think they got enough to make a move. So I'm going to tell you something. Or I'm going to tell you something I already told you again. You're going to have to tell some people what's happening. But don't get into the details of what happened that night. Your wife, well, what you tell her, that's between you and her. And I can't guide you on that. But anybody else, don't get into it. It can be used against you."
A sad, sad wave of sentiment rolled over Sherman. What could he say to Campbell? And how much would she pick up from what other people said about him? 6 years old, so guileless, a little girl who loves flowers and rabbits. "I understand," he said, in an utterly depressed voice. How could Campbell be anything but crushed by it all? After saying goodbye to Killian, he sat at his desk and let the diode green letters and numbers on the computer screens skid in front of his eyes. Logically, intellectually, he knew that Campbell, his little girl, would be the first person to believe him totally and the last to lose faith in him, and yet there was no use trying to think logically and intellectually about it. He could see her tender and exquisite little face. His concern for Campbell had one fortunate effect, at least. It overshadowed the first of his difficult tasks, which was going back in to see Eugene Lopwitz. When he showed up at Lopwitz's suite again, Miss Bales gave him a wary look. Obviously, Lopwitz had told her that he had gone walking out of the room like a lunatic. She directed him to a bombastic French armchair and kept an eye on him for the 15 minutes he was kept waiting before Lopwitz summoned him back in. Lopwitz was standing when Sherman entered the office and didn't offer him a seat. Instead, he intercepted him out in the middle of the room's vast oriental rug as if to say, "Okay, I let you back in, now make it quick." Sherman raised his chin and tried to look dignified, but he felt giddy at the thought of what he was about to reveal, about to confess. "Jean," he said, "I didn't mean to walk out of here so abruptly, but I had no choice. That call that came in while we were talking, you asked me if I had any problems. Well, the fact of the matter is, I do. I'm going to be arrested in the morning." At first, Lopwitz just stared at him. Sherman noticed how thick and wrinkled his eyelids were. Then he said, "Let's go over here," and motioned toward the cluster of wingback chairs. They sat down once more. Sherman felt a twinge of resentment at the look of absorption in Lopwitz's bat face, which had voyeur written all over it. Sherman told him of the Lamb case, as it had first appeared in the press, and then of the visit of the two detectives to his house, although without the humiliating details. All the while he stared at Lopwitz's rapt face and felt the sickening thrill of the hopeless wanton, who flings good money after bad and a good life after vile, weak sins. The temptation to tell all, to be truly wanton, to tell of the sweet, loamy loins of Maria Ruskin and the fight in the jungle and his victory over the two brutes, to tell Lopwitz that whatever he had done it as a man, and that as a man he had been blameless, and more than blameless, perhaps even a hero. The temptation to lay bare the entire drama in which I was not a villain was very nearly more than he could withstand. But he held back. "That was my lawyer who called while I was in here, Jane, and he says I shouldn't go into the details of what happened or didn't happen with anybody right now, but I do want you to know one thing, particularly since I don't know what's going to be said in the press about all this, and that is that I did not hit anybody with my car, or drive it recklessly, or do anything else that I can't have a completely clear conscience about." As soon as he said conscience, he realized that every guilty man talks about his clear conscience. "Who's your lawyer?" asked Lopwitz. "His name is Thomas Killian." "Don't know him. You ought to get Roy Branner. He's the greatest litigator in New York. Fabulous. If I was ever in a jam, I'd get Roy. If you want him, I'll call him." Nonplussed, Sherman listened as Lopwitz went on about the power of the fabulous Roy Branner, and the cases he had won, and how he first met him, and how close they were, and how their wives knew each other, and how much Roy would do for him if he, Gene Lopwitz, said the word. So that was Lopwitz's overpowering instinct upon hearing of this crisis in Sherman's life, to tell him of his inside knowledge and the important people he knew and what a hold he, the magnetic baron, had over the big name. The second instinct was more practical. It was set off by the word press. Lopwitz proposed, in a way that did not invite debate, that Sherman take a leave of absence until this unfortunate matter was resolved. This perfectly reasonable suggestion, calmly made, set off a neural alarm. If he took a leave of absence, he might, he wasn't completely sure, he might still draw his base salary of $10,000 a month, which was less than half of what he had to pay each month in loan payments, but he would no longer share in commissions and bond trading division profits. For all practical purposes, he would have no more income. The telephone on Lopwitz's Irish Chippendale side table rang with its little cooing ring. Lopwitz picked it up. "Yeah, you do?" Big smile. "Terrific. Hello? Hello, Bobby? You hear me all right?" He looked at Sherman and gave him a relaxed smile and mouthed the man's name, Bobby Shafflett. Then he looked down and concentrated on the receiver. His face was creased and crinkled with purest joy.
"You'd say it's okay? Wonderful. I'm glad to do it. They've given you something to eat, I assume. Good, good. Now listen. You need anything, you just ask them. They're nice fellas. Do you know they both flew in Vietnam? Oh, sure. They're terrific fellas. You want a drink or anything, you just ask them. I keep some 1934 Armagnac on the plane. I think it's stowed in the back. Ask the smaller one, Tony. He knows where it is." "Well, when you come back tonight, then. It's great stuff. That's the greatest year there ever was for Armagnac, 1934. It's very smooth. It'll help you relax." "So it's okay, huh? Great. Well, what? Not at all, Bobby. Glad to do it, glad to do it."
When he hung up, he couldn't have looked happier. The most famous opera singer in America was in his airplane, hitching a ride to Vancouver, Canada, with Lopwitz's own two former Air Force captains, veterans of combat in Vietnam, as chauffeurs and butlers, serving him Armagnac more than half a century old, $1,200 a bottle, and now this wonderful, round, famous fellow was thanking him, paying his respects from 40,000 feet above the state of Montana. Sherman stared at Lopwitz's smiling face and grew frightened. Lopwitz wasn't angry at him. He wasn't perturbed. He wasn't even particularly put out. No, the fate of Sherman McCoy didn't make all that much difference. Lopwitz's English reproduction life would endure Sherman McCoy's problems, and Pearson Pierce would endure them. Everybody would enjoy the juicy story for a while, and bonds would go on being sold in vast quantities, and the new chief bond salesman, who, Raleigh, or somebody else, would show up in Lopwitz's Tea at the Connaught conference room to discuss raking Pearson Pierce's billions to this part of the market or that. Another air-to-ground telephone call from some fat celebrity, and Lopwitz wouldn't even remember who he was.
"Bobby Shafflett," said Lopwitz, as if he and Sherman were sitting around having a drink before dinner. "He was over in Montana when he called."
He shook his head and chuckled, as if to say, "A hell of a guy." Chapter 21. The Fabulous Koala. Never in his life had he seen things, the things of everyday life, more clearly, and his eyes poisoned every one of them. In the bank on Nassau Street, which he had entered hundreds of times, where tellers, guards, junior officers, and the manager himself knew him as the estimable Mr. McCoy of Pearson Pierce and called him by name, where he was so esteemed, in fact, they had given him a personal loan of $1.8 million to buy his apartment, and that loan cost him $21,000 a month, and where was it going to come from? Oh, God! He now noticed the smallest things. The egg and dart molding around the cornice on the main floor, the old bronze shades on the lamps on the check-writing desks in the middle of the lobby, the spiral fluting on the posts supporting the railing between the lobby and the section where the officers sat, all so solid, so precise, so orderly, and now so specious, such a mockery, so worthless, offering no protection at all. Everybody smiled at him. Kind, respectful, unsuspecting souls. Today, still, Mr. McCoy, Mr. McCoy, Mr. McCoy, Mr. McCoy, Mr. McCoy. How very sad to think that in this solid, orderly place, tomorrow... $10,000 in cash. Killian said the bail money had to be in cash. The teller was a young black woman, no more than 25, wearing a blouse with a high-neck stock and a gold pin, a cloud with a face blowing the wind, in gold. His eyes fastened upon the strange sadness of the wind's face of gold. If he presented her with a check for $10,000, would she question it? Would he have to go to a bank officer and explain? What would he say? For bail? The estimable Mr. McCoy, Mr. McCoy, Mr. McCoy, Mr. McCoy. In fact, all she said was, "You know we have to report all transactions of $10,000 or more, don't you, Mr. McCoy?" "Report?" "To a bank officer." She must have seen the puzzlement on his face because she said, "To the government. We have to fill out a form." Then it dawned on him. It was a regulation designed to foil drug dealers who did business in large amounts of cash. "How long does it take? Does it involve a lot of paperwork?" "No, we just fill out the form. We have all the information we need on file, your address and so on." "Well, all right, that's fine. How would you like it? In hundreds?" Yes, in hundreds." He didn't have the faintest idea of what $10,000 in $100 bills would look like. She left the window and soon returned with what looked like a small paper brick with a band of paper around it. "Here you are. This is $100 $100 bills. He smiled nervously. "That's it? Doesn't look like much, does it?" "Well, depends. All bills come in packages of 100, the ones same as the hundreds. When you see 100 on there, it's impressive enough, I guess." He propped his attaché case up on the marble sill of the window and snapped open the lid and took the paper brick from her and put it inside and snapped the case shut and then glanced at her face again. She knew, didn't she? She knew there was something sordid about having to take out such a desperate amount of cash. There was bound to be. In fact, her face betrayed neither approval nor disapproval. She smiled politely to show her goodwill, and a wave of fear swept over him. Goodwill. What would she or any other black person who looked into the face of Sherman McCoy think tomorrow of the man who ran down a black honor student and left him to die? As he walked down Nassau toward Wall, on his way to Dunning, Spongett, and Leach, he had an attack of money anxiety. The $10,000 had pretty well wiped out his checking account. He had another $16,000 or so in a so-called money market savings account that could be shifted at any time to the checking account. This was money he kept on hand for incidentals, the ordinary bills that came up every month and would keep on coming up, like waves at the shore. And now what? Very shortly he would have to invade principle, and there wasn't that much principle. Had to stop thinking about it. He thought of his father. He would be there in 5 minutes. He couldn't imagine it, and that would be nothing compared to Judy and Campbell. As he walked into his father's office, his father rose up from the chair behind his desk, but Sherman's poisoned eyes picked out the most insignificant thing, the saddest thing. Just across from his father's window, in a window of the new glass and aluminum building across the street, a young white woman was staring at the street below and probing the intertrachean notch of her left ear with a Q-tip. A very plain young woman with tight curly hair staring at the street and cleaning her ears. How very sad. The street was so narrow, he felt as if he could reach out and rap on the plate glass where she stood. The new building had cast his father's little office into a perpetual gloom. He had to keep the lights on at all times. At Dunning, Spongett, and Leach, old partners, such as John Campbell McCoy, were not forced to retire, but they were expected to do the right thing. This meant giving up grand offices and grand views to make way for the rising middle-agelings, lawyers in their 40s and early 50s still swollen with ambition and visions of grander views, grander offices.
"Come in, Sherman," said his father, the erstwhile Lion, with a smile and also a wary note.
No doubt he had been able to tell from the tone of Sherman's voice on the telephone that this would not be an ordinary visit. The Lion, He was still an impressive figure, with his aristocratic chin and his thick white hair combed straight back, and his English suit and his heavy watch chain across the belly of his vest. But his skin seemed thin and delicate, as if at any moment his entire leonine hide might crumple inside all the formidable worsted clothes. He motioned toward the armchair by his desk and said quite pleasantly,
"The bond market must be in the doldrums. Suddenly I rate a visit in the middle of the day."
A visit in the middle of the day. The Lion's old office had not only been on the corner, it had commanded a view of New York Harbor. What bliss it had been, as a boy, to go visit Daddy in his office. From the moment he stepped off the elevator on the 18th floor, he was His Majesty the Child. Everyone, the receptionist, the junior partners, even the porters, knew his name and sang it out as if nothing could bring greater happiness to the loyal subjects of Dunning Spunget than the sight of his little face and budding aristocratic chin. All other traffic seemed to come to a halt as His Majesty the Child was escorted down the hall and deep into the CEO's suite to the office of the Lion himself, on the corner, where the door opened and, glorious, the sun flooded in from over the harbor, which was spread out for him down below. The Statue of Liberty, the Staten Island ferries, the tugboats, the police boats, the cargo ships coming in through the narrows in the distance. What a show! For him! What bliss! Several times, in that glorious office, they came close to sitting down and having a real talk. Young as he was, Sherman had perceived that his father was trying to open a door in his formality and beckon him through. And he had never known quite how. Now, in the blink of an eye, Sherman was 38, and there was no door at all. How could he put it? In his entire life, he had never dared embarrass his father with a single confession of weakness, let alone moral decay and abject vulnerability.
"Well, how's it going at Pearson Pierce?"
Sherman laughed a mirthless laugh.
"I don't know. It's going on without me, that much I know."
His father leaned forward.
"You're not leaving?"
"In a manner of speaking." He still didn't know how to put it. So, weakly, guiltily, he fell back on the shock approach, the blunt demand for sympathy that had worked with Gene Lopwitz. "Dad, I'm going to be arrested in the morning." His father stared at him for what seemed like a very long time, then opened his mouth and closed it and sighed a little sigh, as if rejecting all of mankind's usual responses of surprise or disbelief when a disaster is announced. What he finally said, while perfectly logical, puzzled Sherman.
"By whom?"
"By the police. The New York City police."
"On what charge?"
Such bewilderment and pain on his face. Oh, he had stunned him all right, and probably demolished his capacity to get angry. And how contemptible a strategy it was. Reckless endangerment, leaving the scene of an accident, failure to report an accident.
"Automobile," said his father, as if talking to himself. "And they're going to arrest you tomorrow?"
Sherman nodded and began his sordid story, all the while studying his father's face and noting, with relief and guilt, that he remained stunned. Sherman dealt with the subject of Maria with Victorian delicacy, scarcely knew her, had only seen her three or four times in innocuous situations, should never have flirted with her, of course. Flirted.
"Who is this woman, Sherman?"
"She's married to a man named Arthur Ruskin."
"Ah, I think I know who you mean. He's Jewish, isn't he?"
"What earthly difference does it make?"
"Yes? And who is she?"
"She's from some place in South Carolina."
"What was her maiden name?"
"Her maiden name? Dean? I don't think she's Colonial Dames material, Dad." When he got as far as the first appearance of the stories in the newspapers, Sherman could tell his father didn't want to hear any more of the sordid details. He interrupted again.
"Who's representing you, Sherman? I assume you do have a lawyer."
"Yes. His name is Thomas Killian."
"Never heard of him. Who is he?"
With a heavy heart. He's with a firm called Dershkin, Bellavita, Fishbein, and Schlossel. The lion's nostrils quivered, and his jaw muscles bunched up, as if he were trying to keep from retching.
How on earth did you find them?
They specialize in criminal law. Freddy Button recommended them.
Freddy? You let Freddy?
He shook his head. He couldn't find the words. He's my lawyer.
I know, Sherman, but Freddy...
The lion glanced toward the door and then lowered his voice. Freddy's a perfectly fine person, Sherman, but this is a serious matter.
You turned me over to Freddy, Dad, a long time ago. I know, but not for anything important.
He shook his head some more. Bewilderment upon bewilderment. Well, in any event, I'm represented by a lawyer named Thomas Killian.
Ah, Sherman.
A far-off weariness. The horse is out of the barn.
I wish he had come to me as soon as this thing happened. Now, at this stage, well, but that's where we are, isn't it? So, let's try to go from here. One thing I'm quite sure of. You have to find the very best representation available. You've got to find lawyers you can trust implicitly, because you're putting an awful lot in their hands. You can't just go wandering into some people named Dershbein, whatever it is. I'm going to call Chester Whitman and Ed LaPrade and sound them out.
Chester Whitman and Ed LaPrade? Two old federal judges who were either retired or close to it. The likelihood of their knowing anything about the machinations of a Bronx district attorney or a Harlem rabble-rouser was so remote. And all at once, Sherman felt sad, not so much for himself as for this old man before him, clinging to the power of connections that meant something back in the 1950s and early 1960s.
"Miss Needleman," the lion was already on the telephone, "would you ring up Judge Chester Whitman for me, please?" "What?" "Oh, I see. Well, when you're through, then."
He hung up the receiver. As an old partner, he no longer had a secretary of his own. He shared one with half a dozen others, and obviously she, Miss Needleman, did not jump when the lion opened his mouth. Waiting, the lion looked out his solitary window and pursed his lips and looked very old. And in that moment, Sherman made the terrible discovery that men make about their fathers sooner or later. For the first time, he realized that the man before him was not an aging father, but a boy much like himself. A boy who grew up and had a child of his own, and, as best he could, out of a sense of duty and perhaps love, adopted a role called being a father, so that his child would have something mythical and infinitely important, a protector, who would keep a lid on all the chaotic and catastrophic possibilities of life. And now that boy, that good actor, had grown old and fragile and tired, wearier than ever at the thought of trying to hoist the protector's armor back onto his shoulders again, now, so far down the line. The lion looked away from the window and straight at Sherman, and smiled, with what Sherman interpreted as a kindly embarrassment.
"Sherman," he said, "promise me one thing. You won't lose heart. I wish you'd come to me sooner, but that doesn't matter. You're going to have my complete support, and you're going to have mother's. Whatever we can do for you, we will."
For an instant, Sherman thought he was talking about money. On second thought, he knew he wasn't. By the standards of the rest of the world outside of New York, his parents were rich. In fact, they had just enough to generate the income that would support the house on 73rd Street and the house on Long Island and provide them with help a few days each week at both places and take care of the routine expenses that would preserve their gentility. But to cut into their principal would be like cutting a vein. He couldn't do that to this well-meaning, gray-haired man who sat before him in this mean little office. And for that matter, he wasn't at all sure that's what was being offered.
"What about Judy?" asked his father.
"Judy?
How has she taken all this?"
"She doesn't know about it yet."
"She doesn't?"
"Not the first thing." Every vestige of an expression left the face of the old gray-haired lad. When Sherman asked Judy to come with him into the library, he had every intention, every conscious intention, of being completely honest. But from the moment he opened his mouth, he was aware of his clumsy secret para-self, the dissembler. It was the dissembler who put that portentous baritone into his voice and who showed Judy to the wing chair the way a funeral director might have done it, and who closed the door to the library with lugubrious deliberateness and then turned about and wrapped his eyebrows around his nose so that Judy could see, without hearing the first word, that the situation was grave. The dissembler didn't sit behind his desk. That would be too corporate a posture, but in the armchair. And then he said, "Judy, I want you to..."